I would like to take the normal order of the presentations and to start with the protocols for management of Professor Cohen. Are there questions from the floor? Well, maybe to start with, Professor Cohen, you told about the nasoalveolar molding, which you developed quite well. We didn't do it because there were some questions about the compliance of the parents. It cost quite a lot of commitment of the parents to hold it through and to continue the treatment. What's your experience with that?
Thank you. As I said, definitely this is something that you have to explain to the parents ahead of time. Definitely one of the drawbacks of the use of the nasoalveolar boarding is the responsibility of the parents to come in every week for adjustment. But to the best of our knowledge, we started now using this technique, I think in 98 or 97, and so therefore we have enough experience to tell you that most of the parents will come back. Actually, we started this trying to help the parents to pay for parking, or sometimes we have volunteers bring them over, but it works well for most practical purposes. Now, if this is the reason why we achieve the best result, certainly not, and certainly there are a lot of people that don't use alveolar molding. I'm very aware of a study from Taipei, from Changgong Hospital, where they went back and the results were very good for 3, 4, 5 years. But then the nose relapses. So there's no question that ultimately you will probably need a second operation, and we'll talk about that this afternoon. However, you set the stage for a much more natural looking nose in the beginning. And as my friend just said also, it's very important. I don't have a longitudinal complete study with consecutive patients, but and so therefore it cannot be very scientific, but the observation is that there's no question the results are better.
Okay.
Thank you.
Professor Kosler-Reddy, what is your opinion about nasoalveolar molding?
There are a lot of studies have been performed for and against. In fact, one of the best studies that was done by Anna-Marie Kupnes-Yatman, where they did a randomized clinical trial for all the orthopedics, the total pre-surgical orthopedics in unilateral complete cleft lip, and they have concluded that it had not much of a role in the outcome of the surgery, in the function, in the speech. Even they did it on the nutrition development of the child also. At the same time, again, there have been very good studies that have been done by NYU and by Taipei in Taiwan. They did show that they had a lot of significant, very good outcomes. And then in the end, the conclusion the Taiwan group has given was a combination of nasoalveolar molding and the surgery plays a role, and also a lot of nasal stenting. This was their outcome. So it's, but in the end, what we need to always make a conclusion is about the burden of care. If you can have the resources of human resources and then the infrastructural resource and the complaints of the parents, probably it might be effective if you have all those. But when you look at the burden of care, I don't think so.
Okay, thank you. What about pressure source of the piece which is pushing the nose? I can imagine that there is some trauma to the skin.
That's a good question also. The initial design was a very crude design, so the extension of the plate inside the nose could create, but it's now very well bonded with soft tissue on top, and we really don't see it.
No problem.
If you reach the point to have a pressure sore, that means you are pushing too hard, and this is an excellent point also, because we have seen what I call mega nostril. In other words, if you push too much, you create a wider nostril, which is very difficult to make shorter on the table.
Okay.
So you have to have experience, And you cannot just tell the mother to take a plier and adjust it. The second thing that has worked very well is the tape. And taping, particularly across the wide lip, it really helps molding the maxilla at the same time. And the same decisions came from Taipei also. It's really very simple and helps. Of course, you have to do it early on. You have to see the child very early. Thank you.
Talking about taping, we can go to the premaxilla in the double cleft lip and palate. And you have good results by taping, but it takes a long time. Now, we are going to developing countries. We see the child once. We have a very protruding premaxilla. Is there a place for a setback at that moment, surgical setback?
Thank you for bringing this up, because these techniques that I presented are, of course, in an ultimate, in a situation where you have all the facilities all the time. It does not delay management of the cleft lip. In other words, cleft lip is still repaired around the time that we used to repair it anyway. However, having said that, setback of the premaxilla is really something that a lot of surgeons are afraid of, while in fact, if you know how to do it, particularly in the bilaterals where the premaxilla is way outside the occlusal plane, and actually my friend Josnia Morty from Chennai, she has reported on adult primary clefts, where again, in order to do the setback, they do the setback and they close the palate. You cannot do a setback and do the lip at the same time.
Because of circulation.
Do the palate, but we don't see adults with clefts in the United States. We might start seeing with the new wave of refugees, but definitely it's something that people that do volunteer surgery should have that under their belt as a technique.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the floor in the meantime? You have a chance now. Vienna meets the world, so you have the chance to show yourself. Professor Vincent.
A question concerning planning. The high-end planning, doing the wax models and the electronic models, and the electronic planning are very similar. And it's very helpful for the surgeon to achieve such excellent results. The next step will be the interaction between the skull and the soft tissues. And I'd like to ask you how you think that this problem will be managed in the next time by diagnostic tools. Professor Montadon?
Well, as I show, it's a very difficult problem when you have to combine the soft tissue with the hard tissue. Usually, the rule of craniofacial surgery by Paul Tessier was to work first on the skeleton and then on the soft tissue. But sometimes you cannot. You have to think the two at the same time. And as we shall see in the afternoon, especially with Noma, it's almost impossible to plan the skeleton without the soft tissue, the reconstruction. If there are any tools, Dr. Patel will tell us if there is any tool that we can obtain to achieve that. I don't know. I really think that's the, as you know, you have to train as best as possible and to do your drawings again and again. And of course, it takes a lot of time, you're thinking before. And I was really happy to have Dr. Tessier for this difficult patient, because otherwise, you know, we didn't know where to start and how to handle the thing. And he had the idea exactly. He told us, you know, point after point. Of course, we couldn't follow what he said, but it's really a surgeon, you know, individual who can do that.
All I showed you was simple carpentry work. That was all it was. And our tools are only good as, our tools are beginning to be pretty good. They're getting better for simple carpentry work, but not for the true tailoring work, I think the cases that Professor Montedon showed and Dr. Reddy here showed are, those are very difficult cases. They involve both soft tissue and skeletal work. And honestly, I don't think I'll see it in my lifetime to have any sort of tools that will really help. I think it really requires the experienced surgeon. It's still one-on-one teaching. And Professor Montedon, you know, depended on Dr. Tessier. And now he has a wealth of experience. And so, you know, we have to teach it from one generation to another so that those arts are not lost, actually. So I don't think the computer will ever replace surgery. It can only make things a little bit simpler, a little bit faster. But I don't think in the end, that's why I only showed you the efficiency, right? That was the only thing I could really show you, was that, yes, it made the operation a little bit efficient in terms of, but it really didn't show you, did I have a good outcome with it in terms of that, in terms of the aesthetics. That's the art part, I think, you know?
Thank you so much. Dr. Schauding?
First of all, I'd like to thank all the speakers for their wonderful contributions to this conference. I actually have two questions to two of the speakers. First, Professor Patel. It was a fantastic, a really fantastic outlook into the future. We are also working on 3D models and 3D planning, but not in such a high level as you are. We're still doing on a stereolithographic models and are bending our plates to them at the, when we are planning the surgery at the model without the computers, and then putting them into sterilization and using them at the operation. My question is a rather technical one. How do you do this custom-made plates? What is the material? And okay, perhaps you can talk about it, but...
If I can pull up my slides, I have a couple slides I'll show it.
Okay, pardon.
Right, so how do you make these plates into reality, right? So we use a software called Freeform. It's a very easy, it's a very complex software, but it's easy to work with. So you can make any kind of shape virtually that you would like. And then once we have the osteotomy gap, we essentially make a plate virtually to fit that osteotomy gap. Just a little bit about plates. As you know, standard plates are basically assembly line process. It's the least expensive way to manufacture. Sheet metal, pressed, and then finished to get a plate out of it, right? So how do you get from a virtual plate to a final plate? Well, I'll show you this very simplistic way of doing it, I think, once you get it. So you take, there are people in the audience who know this. My kids, of course, have never seen this. This is the old RCA TV, and as a kid, actually, growing up, I used to play around with those. I used to take that thing out. That's the cathode ray tube. And actually, when I was in high school, I made it into a scanning electron microscope. I took one apart, but concept same. So what you do is turn it upside down. Titanium, you can buy it as a powder. You can buy it from Amazon, probably, or eBay. But you use titanium to make fireworks. Now, of course, you would want to use a medical-grade titanium. Titanium has a melting point of 1,600 degrees centigrade, which is pretty high, so you have to be able to work with that. And the only thing that could actually melt it is an electron beam. So that's why you can get a cathode ray tube. And then what you do, so if you know what a cathode ray tube is, to work, so you know when you see those pictures that come in the old days, you see the pictures come line by line by line. And so the cathode ray, the electron beam, was monitored with these electromagnets. So you take an old PC like this, and you design it, the device that you want, and basically all you're then doing is controlling the electromagnets, which controls the beam. So you have powder on there, and as the beam moves, it heats up the powder and congeals the powder. And so what you end up doing is you end up with whatever product you like as a plate like that. And that really is the basic concept behind how to make it. Now that's you'd have to buy, the machines are extremely expensive though.
So it's a 3D printing?
It's a 3D printing metal, yeah. Yeah, they're coming out now at a manufacturing level. And I think in the future, I have printed some other types of things too. For some people who are kids who have asymmetry, you can reshape the plate so the plate becomes an implant and a plate as well for fixation. For example, if there's some malar deficiency on one side for a hemifacial microsomia, you can make all sorts of different types. It's only, so I think it's incredible the amount of variety of plates and implants that you can really make. So I think the future is pretty amazing with the ability to do 3D printing. I think, and at some point, everybody will have a 3D printer in their own house. You can buy a printer for $700, you know? It's not very expensive off of Amazon these days.
To be honest, I have already tried that with plastic works.
Right.
I always had the problem but that the hollow elements do not fit out as well as planned. But with metal, we haven't tried
it yet. So the most important thing to remember is that we're surgeons. We're not manufacturers. We're not on that end of the business, end of technology. We're really surgeons. And that's where our skill lies. It's important for us to understand some of the manufacturing process and some of the technologies, because it's really manufacturing and surgeons, or business and surgeons, or engineering surgeons working together to solve problems. We can't really do it ourselves, actually. We have to partner up in order to give the best care possible.
But as far as I understand, you have already found a company that solved the problem with the hollow elements.
Yes, we have, but it's not out yet. So
no, it's no problem. But we can.
We're getting
hope
there.
For that
I think
we're
all going to be there soon.
Thank you.
Okay, Dr. Shawley, your second question.
Yes, it's for Professor Reddy. You've showed us great results when you're using the when you're doing a scepter in a plastic in the first place. We always have the problem that without having a bony base, a scepter in a plastic, that really doesn't work for us. What is your secret?
The key is trying to understand the cleft septum. You have a lot of excess tissue at the base, one. So here you're disjunctioning it from the nasal spine, and the anterior aspect of the omorine attachments is only mobilized. And then it is going to be, we're going to do the periosteoplasty. When you do the periosteoplasty, the alveolus is closed, one. And next thing is you're taking the ala nasalis muscle sling, the ala nasalis muscle sling from the contralateral side, and then it goes through the septum, and then it attaches there at the inferiorly. And then
on the muscle.
On the muscle. Muscle is the one which is holding it.
Yeah.
And the next thing is the mucoperichondrium, we need to attach it back to the septum again, and then we quilt it so that the septum is totally moved, and then it stays in that place by doing these three measures. One is ala nasalis, second is the suturing of the mucoperichondrium, and third most important thing is the mobilization itself.
Okay, thank you, thank you.
Okay, are there other questions from the floor?
No?
And now from the panel, yes.
Excellent presentation from all. Dr. Reddy, I love your numbers. I mean, we will never be able to achieve, and certainly the way you're thinking and working. I was always taught, and that's back to what I mentioned earlier with Skook. He started doing periosteoplasties from the maxilla to bridge the gap of the cleft at the time of lip repair. And he showed some fabulous results back in the late 60s. And then he himself decided that no more, because it worked very well in the infant. But then as you see the growing craniofacial skeleton, it had tremendous deleterious effect in the growth of the maxilla, not at age 2 or 3, but maybe a little later. Now, I noticed that you are revamping the idea, and we would really much would like to know how far down the road you are checking these patients, and what do you think is going to happen, whether it's Cook had it wrong, or we all have it wrong.
It's a very good observation, in fact. Yes, this was what we had in the mind. And then we are following the children right now for 10 years. In fact, none of them had. I think what the thing difference between Skoog and us is, Skoog has just done only periosteoplasty. He has not done the total facial mask lift. That's one. And second is he has not done the muscle orientation on his lip. And then he has not done the primary septoplasty. So I think these are the key factors for the growth and not the periosteoplasty. Probably that's where he might have missed in 1960. And I think we are able to crack the code in 2010 now. And we published our results after 10 years already in that. And then there's no growth. In fact, by doing the periosteoplasty, it is acting like your nasoalveolar molding. It medializes your shelves, especially when you have a wide difference in the alveolar ridges. This medializes. And then when we do the total facial mask lift, that itself orients all the periosteum, lifts upwards and gets it to the nasal spine on the other side. So that is acting like a functionality. So
the concept of damaging the periosteum in the groin craniofacial skeleton in the maxilla and the alveolus is wrong.
It's wrong. It's totally.
Thank you.
Well, this is a good statement to end the discussion. Thank you very much. Also, all the speakers for their contributions.